I'm delighted to welcome Tom O'Connor. He's music director of Santa Fe Pro Musica. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here again.
Nice to have you back. It's been quite a while since we had you on the air.
It has. I don't even remember when it was, but it was a long time ago.
Tell us about Santa Fe Pro Musica. What is it? What do you do?
Well, we are a classical music group, and we have different types of classical music ensembles that we present here in Santa Fe, from period instrument small ensembles in Loretto Chapel, which we do in December. We do a big set called Baroque Christmas that's been in Loretto Chapel now for approaching 30 years. And it's wildly popular. We sell a lot of tickets. We've got people coming from all over, coming back to Santa Fe because it's one of the things that they enjoy at that time of year, especially Christmas Eve, going to the concerts, and then walking up Canyon Road. And, you know, just Santa Fe's just such a magical place anyway, but at that time of year, it's really, really terrific. So that's one aspect.
And for so many people, having a musical presentation has become part of our Christmas celebration.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of families that come to that particular concert, so it's that experience that they're looking for with their kids that is not have the sort of commercial,
commercial sit on Santa's lap and get a
it's not that at all.
Game.
There's a spiritual component to music, especially to classical music, I think, and so you know it's meaningful to people. So that's one aspect of it. We also present in chamber music. We also present string quartets that are part of our season. We've had some of the best string quartets. Brentano Quartet will be here on March the 8th, so that's an upcoming one. We had St. Lawrence Quartet early in our season, and we had a Polish quartet called the Szymanowski Quartet. Karol Szymanowski was a Polish composer, kind of late 19th century, early 20th century, and so the quartet's named after him. So that's another aspect of what we do. And then the final aspect, which is really sort of the biggest part of what we do, are our orchestra concerts. And we're a small orchestra. Sometimes you refer to them as a chamber orchestra. I find that term confusing to people, and they don't know what exactly, well, you've got chamber music and chamber orchestra, exactly how, what does that actually mean?
It sounds like an oxymoron.
Yeah, it kind of does, yeah. So we've really sort of abandoned the term chamber. We're called the Santa Fe Pro Musical Orchestra, and we're very much a flexible kind of group. If we've got a particular repertoire that requires 20 or 25 musicians, then that's what we are. And if we're doing a repertoire like the upcoming concert with Midori, it's a bigger group of around 40. And so it's totally repertoire driven. Whatever we're doing, that's what size we are. And that's the biggest part of our budget. It's the biggest part of our year. And so there are a lot of groups that focus on one particular aspect. They are an orchestra or symphony, and so that's what they do. Or they're a chamber music festival, like the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival in the summer, and it's basically focused on chamber music. We sort of encompass all of those forms. I think a little bit of that is being in a small town and appealing to audiences that have particular interests. You're interested in chamber music, not so much in orchestra. Interested in orchestra, not so much in chamber music. It's been a formula for us that's allowed us to play a really broad, diverse kind of music, to indulge our interest in period instruments, which are instruments that were either copies of or instruments that were in use, say, in the Baroque period. And violin still looks like a violin, but they're actually quite different from what we would call a modern violin. And so that's been, you know, it's been, it's not so much a formula as it is, it's basically appealing to different constituencies in Santa Fe and putting that all together in under one organization.
Now, speaking of violin, the great violinist Midori is going to be here this coming weekend. She's going to be here Saturday and Sunday, the 28th of February and 1st of March. There's also going to be a fundraiser and a youth concert and all sorts of things coming. But tell us about this wonderful instrumentalist.
Well, she really she made her debut when she was 11. She was discovered by Zubin Mehta, and she made her debut with the New York Philharmonic on New Year's Eve at the tender age of 11. She's in her 40s now, so that's, you know, over 30 years ago, or about 30 years ago. And certainly the world's full of talented people and talented instrumentalists, but this young woman has really distinguished herself from the age of 11. And in many respects, I think you could say she's the most famous solo violinist in the world. It's a crowded field, but she's at the top of that field. She's very much into community outreach, into education. She holds a named chair at the Thornton School of Music at USC. It's the Yasha Heifetz Chair, and so she's very dedicated to her students, very dedicated to teaching. Dedicated to the idea that music can transform lives, that it can change people, that it can influence them in ways that are very positive as they grow and develop. So she's, kids are of keen interest to her. The particular piece that she's playing with us is a violin concerto by Robert Schumann, who's one of the mainstays of 19th century classical music. You know, following Schubert, following Beethoven, contemporaneous with Felix Mendelssohn. Brahms is composing at that time, but he lives longer, so he goes a bit later, and Tchaikovsky also. So it's really right in the middle of the of what we call the Romantic movement in classical music.
And by the way, we're going to hear a little bit of that piece at the end of this show.
That's great. So it's a piece that, it's a star-crossed piece. It's a piece that came at the very end of Schumann's life. Many people know the story of Schumann and the difficulties that he had with mental illness. And he was in and out of institutions, and he had kind of a star-crossed, troubled kind of life. And this particular piece was the last major piece that he wrote, and he composed it in the space of 2 weeks in September of 1853. So it's within 6 months he's back in an institution, in an asylum basically, kind of, I think by modern standards, sort of a warehouse for people that are in crisis, that are having a difficult time. And so his mental condition and the fact that it's at the end of his life hugely influences the reception of the piece. And he never gets to hear it, and it doesn't actually get premiered until 75 years later. Not until 1937 does it actually get played. And his wife, Clara Schumann, who's an incredible pianist, has her own career, she's ambivalent about the piece, or conflicted about the piece, because she doesn't know whether or not it really represents Schumann at his best. And, you know, you see in the lives of artists this progression, and there's some early brilliance, and then there's a maturity coming in the middle period, and then at the end it basically all comes together, and some of the great pieces happen, like Beethoven's Ninth. And so, certainly as his wife, she wanted to see that the piece really represented the very best. And she was unsure. She didn't really know for sure. And she wanted to reserve judgment about the piece until she'd heard it. But that opportunity didn't happen. And it was written for a particular violinist named Josef Joachim. And he was a 22-year-old virtuoso, and by far the finest violinist in Europe, and totally celebrated. And he found great difficulty in learning the piece, especially the last movement of it. He found it technically a huge challenge, and one that he really had tremendous difficulty mastering. So there were reading sessions and rehearsals where Joachim played, but Schumann was in attendance, but they were never really up to what Joachim was embarrassed. You know, my arm is tired because I conducted too much in the days before, and my arm is tired, and I still haven't really learned the piece properly yet. And And Schumann, when he comments about it, says, oh, Joachim was tired. And so it's clear that it wasn't really quite satisfactory. It took until the 1930s for the piece to finally become available and to finally get a premiere. And it was going to be premiered by Yehudi Menuhin, who is Jewish. And the Nazis basically prohibited that from happening. And so another violinist played it. And there were all the kinds of problems that you have in classical music with. There's so much detail in classical music and in classical music scores that mistakes are inevitable. And, in copying the parts out or copying the score out, copyists make errors, they make mistakes, and it's, they go through revisions. No, I didn't mean that. No, I didn't mean C sharp. I meant C natural or the transposition in the horns is wrong or whatever it is. And so those kinds of corrections didn't have they didn't happen because Schumann didn't get a performance of the piece and go, oh no, geez, that doesn't work the way I thought it would. I want to change it or whatever. And so the first performances of it really were sort of underwhelming. And they were underwhelming partially because the piece was 75 years old at this time and the aesthetic of Romanticism was gone. We'd been through a world war. We'd been through Arnold Schoenberg and basically blowing up traditional harmony and saying it's dead, there's no juice in it anymore, we need to go in another direction. And then you have the disruption of the Depression. I mean, it's just, the world is a different place. It's not the same anymore. And so people's ears were really not so much attuned to what this piece was actually saying. So it's taken time now to get the mistakes and errors out of the parts to come to publish really what we call urtext, original parts that are free of those kinds of mistakes. And it turns out, at least in my opinion, it's really a fantastic piece. It's a piece that fits in between the Beethoven Violin Concerto and the Brahms Violin Concerto, exactly what Menuhin thought. This is the missing link between these two great pieces from the 19th century. And the Beethoven Violin Concerto is early in the 19th century. The Brahms is way past the mid-mark. And so that's a long period for, there's a Mendelssohn Violin Concerto in there too. That's a pretty good piece that people love. But there's still, kind of something missing there. And Schumann turned to the concerto form. He wrote a piano concerto, which people know well, and it's a fantastic piece, and also a cello concerto in the last years of his life. So he's really focusing on concerto repertoire. And back to Clara for just a second. She compiled a catalog, as did Joachim, of Schumann's works. She didn't even mention the violin concerto. It's not even in there. That's how conflicted and unsure she was that it really wasn't. It was influenced by his mental condition, and she felt. So now, that's the piece she's playing.
That's the piece she's playing. Now, you said earlier it was a very challenging and difficult piece.
Yeah.
One of the things that's happened in classical music and in a lot of different fields is that players are ever more virtuosic. They can do unbelievable things.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And the pool of players who have the technical capability of playing the Schumann well probably numbers in the dozens or maybe there are even 100 that can just play the heck out of this piece.
Which is not a lot of people compared to the number of violinists out there.
No, it isn't. It's still a very, very hard piece. And it hasn't gotten the opportunity to be heard as much as it deserves to be heard, I believe. And it has this kind of star-crossed history that has, made people have an opinion about it that maybe is unfair, that the music is complex. It takes time to absorb it. It's a piece that benefits by being heard more than once. I know that I knew about the piece, but I had never played it before as an oboist in an orchestra. I'd never had a chance to play it before. It was never programmed in any of the groups that I was playing in. And when this opportunity to work with Midori came up, I thought, well, to have one of the top violinists in the world here is a great privilege and great honor, and her name alone will help sell the concert. It's not the Beethoven Violin Concerto or Tchaikovsky or Brahms, but so I went and I listened to it, and I was, you know, kind of underwhelmed, but I thought, well, it doesn't, you know, it won't matter. It really won't matter. It shouldn't affect the sales of the concert or anything. But as I started to study it and hear it more, there's a subtlety in Schumann's harmony that is uniquely his voice, and it comes through in this piece in ways that remind me of what a genius he was, and for the listener, what power he has to transport you to another place. It's as if you catch yourself, the piece is going along in a, I don't want to say predictable, but everything is kind of in order and you understand what's happening, and then all of a sudden the harmony changes, and it's this as if you catch yourself daydreaming, or as if you're out in the sun on your porch and a cloud comes by and it covers the sun and suddenly you're cold. And it's an uncanny power. And sometimes it lasts just seconds, and then things return to a more sort of predictable, for lack of a better word, progression. I find that really very special, but you can't appreciate those things just by hearing it once. It's the repeated listening that identifies these spots, and then you truly get to savor them because you have an understanding.
We're talking to Tom O'Connor, music director of Santa Fe Pro Musica. I would think that what you're saying is even more true if you're playing it. I mean, it's one thing to go buy the CD or download it and listen to it a bunch of times, but then if you're the oboist or whatever other instrument you're playing in the orchestra, playing it would make it even that much more intense of getting to know the piece.
I think so, and of course in performance, you know, you have the nature of performance is this interplay, this give and take back and forth, especially in a concerto between the soloist and the orchestra, and sometimes, you know, concertos are described as battles, you know, a battle between the soloist and the orchestra. And who's going to prevail? I never really look at concertos that way or think about them in that way. And I think of them more as these collaborations where we're not improvising, but we're inspired by what we hear, and we are reacting to what we hear. And I hear a particular kind of phrasing coming from the soloist, and I want to incorporate that phrasing into the orchestra part to the extent that I can. And so it's not static in the way that listening to a CD is static. You know, you're passive. You have no influence over what's going on. Performing a classical music piece, you have tremendous impact on the dialogue that's going on, to affect it, to change it in subtle and wonderful ways for the musicians and for the audience.
How would you describe Midori's playing? What does she bring to the violin that's special and unique?
Well, she has one of the best strads that exists, okay? So she has a great instrument. She has phenomenal physical talent, phenomenal physical ability, and a player at that level can make a difficult piece sound easy. And so you don't even appreciate that it's hard. You don't even hear that it's hard because it doesn't sound hard. It sounds easy. You couple that kind of physical skill and musical development with one of the great violins, and you get something that is has the ability to transport people. It has the ability to hold opposites together at the same moment. It's great players playing great music have the power to move us, and ultimately in classical music that is the goal. There's a certain amount of flash and dash always. We want, you know, audiences can be amazed or astonished, but the real goal is to find the heart of the piece, the core of the piece, and to move the audience that you feel that it connected with you on a deep emotional level. It brought you to places. You know, how many kinds of sad are there? You know, as many kinds of sad as there are people. How many kinds of happy are there? And so it has the ability to expand your understanding of a particular emotion by giving you a different shade, a slightly different shade of that emotion.
And giving that emotion to you in the form of a nonverbal medium.
Absolutely. We're not tied to a visual reference. We're not tied to something graphic. It's the most abstract art form, and in that way, I think it's the most powerful.
So Midori will be in Santa Fe playing this concerto by Robert Schumann on February 28th, which is Saturday at 4 in the afternoon, and then Sunday, March 1st at 3 in the afternoon. And you're also going to do a little fundraiser at Restaurant Martine on Sunday, the 1st of March. Tell us about that.
It's just an opportunity for concert goers to, first of all, go to one of the best restaurants in Santa Fe with one of the most creative chefs in Santa Fe, and to have an opportunity to be with Midori to understand another aspect of her personality and character, to see her not as this performer on stage, but as one of us, another human being, trying to make the most of her time here and to make the most of her talent to impact people as positively as she can with this great gift that she has. And
so you'll all be eating together?
Yeah, we're eating together and probably having a glass of wine or two also. And reflecting, hopefully we'll have a chance to maybe talk a little bit like this, but in front of the group who comes to the dinner. And I'm curious as to what she thinks of this concerto. I'm sure that she loves it, but what does it mean to her? And what are the challenges and what are the rewards of playing it well? And just questions that only the soloist could really answer.
Now, there's also a youth concert on Friday.
Yeah, there is. We do youth concerts with all of our orchestra concerts, and we're trying to help the school students and the teachers accomplish the goals that they have set out for them in their curriculum. And so we provide the teachers with these packages that have a combination of kind of a musical dictionary to define terms, a little bit of history about the composers and instruments, for the younger kids, games, that might be, find oboe in this crossword puzzle, or find flute, or find circle all the instruments, things like that, to just try to engage them a bit more. We've been doing it for a long time, and I've developed a particular approach to the youth concerts. We don't program specifically for kids. We play what we're playing. If we're playing a Beethoven symphony, they're going to hear a Beethoven symphony. If they're going to hear a Schumann violin concerto. So we don't water the programming down. And what I try to do is give them listening tools. Here's what's going on in the score. Here's what the low strings are doing. Here's what the high strings are doing. Let's hear them separately. Let's hear them together. And here's what the winds are doing. Things like that to try to give them little places where they can kind of hear differently instead of just sort of being overwhelmed by, 40 people up there playing. Maybe their attention is focused on the double bass or the first violins So it's basically, developing listening tools.
Yeah, if they don't play music and haven't been exposed that much to classical music, the texture of an orchestra, it's very hard to pick apart.
Yeah, it is. It's I think for many of the kids, our focus is really on elementary age students. So for many of these kids, this is their first exposure to a live orchestra. It may be the first time that they've actually been in a concert type situation, which is it's a sort of a new experience. It's an intellectual experience. It's the gateway. Yeah, your eyes are involved, but it's really about your ears, about hearing and making some differentiation about what you're hearing, some understanding about what you're hearing. The kids are amazing. They don't come in with the preconceptions that you and I have about what we like and what we don't like. They don't know yet. They haven't heard it. They like it.
Yeah.
It speaks to them. Beethoven speaks to them.
And those
powerfully.
those moments that you have as a school kid stay with you your whole life.
They do. I remember a situation in high school where it was an assembly for our entire high school. There were 1,000 people in the auditorium. It was full of kids. And there was the guest was a viola player, a university professor, viola player, and he had an instrument called the viola d'amore. And the viola d'amore is an instrument that doesn't really exist anymore.
The love viola. The love viola.
Yeah, the love viola. And it has sympathetic strings underneath the strings that you bow. And so it has a very eerie, sort of sweet kind of sound. Again, sort of an otherworldly sound because of the sympathetic strings that are vibrating under the ones that you're bowing. And it's not a very loud instrument. And the auditorium wasn't particularly great auditorium. It was, you know, it was kind of dead. And, you know, wasn't your greatest concert hall. I remember that event still.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't a clue what we were doing in English or math or social studies or chemistry. I don't remember any of that. But boy, do I remember that guy up there playing the viola d'amore. You know, so yeah. And it can have a big impact. And what's happened with the youth concerts is that we have the teachers self-select, okay? So we send out the word early in the year, late in the summer, actually. You know, these are the youth concerts. Here's the schedule. We pay for the buses. We try to remove any impediment that would prevent a teacher from bringing the students. We try to design our pre-concert packets and the thrust of our program to the benchmarks that the teachers need to achieve so that it can be viewed as, oh, I can check that one off, we did that. And so the teachers self-select. And so we find that we have a lot of the teachers bringing their kids back time after time after time. So I'll ask them, how many of you heard a Pro Musica concert before? And half the kids in the auditorium have their hands up.
Nice.
So they already know about the way the orchestra is put together. And they already know about melody and accompaniment and about rhythm and about concerto and about symphony and about the things that, you know, what is a symphony and how is it different from a concerto? They know all that stuff because they've been there. And they are remarkably attentive and quiet. Sometimes we might have a public concert where you have a hacker or two, you know, somebody with a cough, that are noisier than the kids' concerts. They listen, and I guess my mantra on that is, if you speak to them like you would speak to anyone else, and don't talk down to them, don't assume they don't know anything, that they will be receptive to you.
Tom O'Connor is music director of Santa Fe Pro Musica. They are on the web at santafepromusica.com. And once again, Midori joins the Santa Fe Pro Musica Orchestra at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts this Saturday and Sunday, February 28th and March 1st, Saturday at 4 o'clock and Sunday at 3 o'clock. And you can also go to the Pro Musica website to find out more about the fundraiser at Restaurant Martine.
By the way, I want to thank our good friends for the event at Restaurant Martine, Cindy Tanner and Valerie Levine of Parasol Productions, for putting together the after-concert dinner at Restaurant Martine. They're terrific.
I want to thank you so much, Tom, for being with us in the Radio Cafe.
Thank
Amazing work you're doing.
Thank you. It's fun to talk to you.